Hey, everybody, and welcome to Back to School, where learning and liberty meet. This is Kathy Wells, and this is the third part of a series where I am reading to you Bastiat's treatise, The Law. So you can go listen to parts one and two. You'll be a lot more aware of what's going on in part three. All right, so here we are. We are at the little subheading that says The Seductive Lure of Socialism. And by and large, I'm going to stop reading you the little subheadings because I think it's a little confusing. So I'm going to stop doing that. All right, here we go. Here I encounter the most popular fallacy of our times. It is not considered sufficient that the law should be just. It must be philanthropic. Nor is it sufficient that the law should guarantee to every citizen the free and inoffensive use of his faculties for physical, intellectual, and moral self-improvement. Instead, it is demanded that the law should directly extend welfare, education, and morality throughout the nation. Now, you've heard it said, by the way, this is my commentary, that you can't legislate morality. And I've actually heard some prominent Christian, very prominent Christian speakers say, oh, no, you can legislate morality. Well, no, you can't. Not in the sense that we're talking about here. All right. This is the seductive lure of socialism. And I repeat again, these two uses of the law are in direct contradiction to each other. We must choose between them. A citizen cannot at the same time be free and not free. Mr. de Lamartine once wrote to me thus, "Your doctrine is only the half of my program. You have stopped at liberty. I go on to fraternity." I answered him, "The second half of your program will destroy the first." This is true. In fact, it is impossible for me to separate the word fraternity from the word voluntary. I cannot possibly understand how fraternity can be legally enforced without liberty being legally destroyed, and thus justice being legally trampled underfoot. Now, I want to talk to you about something in Christian circles that's very similar. You know, you've heard the word submission, and I was in a church at one point where it was taught that, you know, basically that submission was equated with obedience. But just like fraternity, submission implies what? Voluntary nature. There can be no law, and I tried to point this out, which of course didn't go over well. There can be no law regulating submission. Otherwise, it would be obedience. There can be no law saying you must, quote, submit. That's not submission, that's obedience. So he's saying the same thing with fraternity, which is like brotherly love, right? Philos, which is a Greek root, which is where, by the way, Philadelphia comes from. Anyway, he's saying that fraternity, brotherly love, must be voluntary, right? Okay. Legal plunder has two roots. One of them, as I have said before, is human greed. The other is in false philanthropy. At this point, I think that I should explain exactly what I mean by the word plunder. I do not, as is often done, use the word in any vague, uncertain, approximate, or metaphorical sense. I use it in its scientific acceptance, as expressing the idea opposite to that of property, wages, land, money, or whatever. When a portion of wealth is transferred from the person who owns it without his consent and without compensation, and whether by force or by fraud, to anyone who does not own it, then I say that property, again, property, very important, is violated, that an act of plunder is committed. I say that this act is exactly what the law is supposed to suppress, always and everywhere. When the law itself commits this act that it is supposed to suppress, I say that plunder is still committed. And I add that from the point of view of society and welfare, this aggression against rights is even worse. In this case of legal plunder, however, the person who receives the benefits is not responsible for the act of plundering. The responsibility for this legal plunder rests with the law, the legislator, and society itself. Therein lies the political danger. It is to be regretted that the word plunder is offensive. I have tried in vain to find an inoffensive word, for I would not at any time, especially now, wish to add an irritating word to our dissensions. Thus, whether I am believed or not, I declare that I do not mean to attack the intentions or the morality of anyone. Rather, I am attacking an idea which I believe to be false. a system which appears to me to be unjust, an injustice so independent of personal intentions that each of us profits from it without wishing to do so, and suffers from it without knowing the cause of the suffering. The sincerity of those who advocate protectionism, socialism, and communism is not here questioned. Any writer who would do that must be influenced by a political spirit or a political fear. It is to be pointed out, however, that protectionism, socialism, and communism are basically the same plant in three different stages of its growth. All that can be said is that legal plunder is more visible in communism because it is complete plunder. Okay, so he's saying here what I've been saying. Socialism leads to communism, and that was part of the plan. And I believe we are at the somewhere between protectionism, socialism, somewhere in there. All right. And in protectionism, because the plunder is limited to specific groups and industries, thus it follows that, of the three systems, socialism is the vaguest, the most indecisive, and consequently the most sincere stage of development. But sincere or insincere, the intentions of persons are not here under question. In fact, I have already said that legal plunder is based partially on philanthropy, even though it is a false philanthropy. With this explanation, let us examine the value, the origin, and the tendency of this popular aspiration, which claims to accomplish the general welfare by general plunder. Since the law organizes justice, the socialists ask why the law should not also organize labor, education, and religion. Why should not law be used for these purposes? Because it could not organize labor, education, and religion without destroying justice. We must remember that law is force. That's a very key point. And that, consequently, the proper functions of the law cannot lawfully extend beyond the proper functions of force. When law and force keep a person within the bounds of justice, they impose nothing but a mere negation. They oblige him only to abstain from harming others. They violate neither his personality, his liberty, nor his property. They safeguard all of these. They are defensive. They defend equally the rights of all. The harmlessness of the mission performed by law and lawful defense is self-evident. The usefulness is obvious, and the legitimacy cannot be disputed. As a friend of mine once remarked, this negative concept of law is so true that the statement, "The purpose of the law is to cause justice to reign," is not a rigorously accurate statement. It ought to be stated that the purpose of law is to prevent injustice from reigning. In fact, it is injustice, not justice, that has an existence of its own. Justice is achieved only when injustice is absent. I guess that's like saying dark is the absence of light. But when the law, by means of its necessary agent, force, imposes upon men a regulation of labor, a method or a subject of education, a religious faith or creed, then the law is no longer negative. It acts positively upon people. This is a good point, people. It substitutes the will of the legislator for their own wills, the initiative of the legislator for their own initiatives. When this happens, the people no longer need to discuss, compare, or plan ahead. The law does all of this for them. Intelligence becomes a useless prop for the people. Let me repeat that. Intelligence becomes a useless prop for the people. They cease to be men. They lose their personality, their liberty, their property. And I would add to this, and they don't care. And this is where we are at as a nation. Try to imagine a regulation of labor imposed by force that is not a violation of liberty, a transfer of wealth imposed by force that is not a violation of property. If you cannot reconcile these contradictions, then you must conclude that the law cannot organize labor and industry without organizing injustice. And just to talk to you a little bit about economics, you can read the essay I, Pencil, which Mabry points out in his book, and I'm sure it's free online somewhere, and it's a really good illustration of why we don't need government to organize labor and industry. All right, continuing on with Bastiat, when a politician views society from the seclusion of his office, he is struck by the spectacle of the inequality that he sees. He deplores the deprivations which are the lot of so many of our brothers, deprivations which appear to be even sadder when contrasted with luxury and wealth. Perhaps the politician should ask himself whether the state of affairs has not been caused by old conquests and lootings and by more recent legal plunder. That is a key point. Perhaps he should consider this proposition. Since all persons seek well-being and perfection, would not a condition of justice be sufficient to cause the greatest efforts towards progress and the greatest possible equality that is compatible with individual responsibility? Would not this be in accord with the concept of individual responsibility which God has willed in order that mankind may have the choice between vice and virtue and the resulting punishment and reward? But the politician never gives this a thought. His mind turns to organizations, combinations, and arrangements, legal or apparently legal. He attempts to remedy the evil by increasing and perpetuating the very thing that caused the evil in the first place, legal plunder. We have seen that justice is a negative concept. Is there even one of these political legal action, positive legal actions that does not contain the principle of plunder? This very key point, the negative versus the positive. You say there are persons who have no money, and you turn to the law. But the law is not a breast that fills itself with milk, nor are the lacteal veins of the law supplied with milk from a source outside the society. Nothing can enter the public treasury for the benefit of one citizen or one class unless other citizens and other classes have been forced to send it in. If every person draws from the treasury the amount that he has put in it, it is true that the law then plunders nobody. But this procedure does nothing for the persons who have no money. It does not promote equality of income. The law can be an instrument of equalization only as it takes from some persons and gives to others. When the law does this, it is an instrument of plunder. With this in mind, examine the protective tariffs, subsidies, guaranteed profits, guaranteed jobs, relief and welfare schemes, public education, progressive taxation, free credit, and public works. You will find that they are always based on legal plunder, organized injustice. You say, there are persons who lack education, and you turn to the law. But the law is not in itself a torch of learning which shines its light abroad. The law extends over a society where some persons have knowledge and others do not, where some citizens need to learn and others can teach. In this matter of education, the law has only two alternatives. It can permit this transaction of teaching and learning to operate freely and without the use of force, or it can force human wills in this matter by taking from some of them enough to pay the teachers who are appointed by government to instruct others without charge. But in the second case, the law commits legal plunder by violating liberty and property. You say, here are persons who are lacking in morality or religion, and you turn to the law. But law is force. And need I point out what a violent and futile effort is to force in the matters of morality and religion, to use force in the matters of morality and religion? It would seem that socialists, however self-complacent, could not avoid seeing this monstrous legal plunder that results from such systems and such efforts. But what do the socialists do? They cleverly disguise this legal plunder from others, even from themselves, under the seductive names of fraternity, unity, organization, and association. Because we ask so little from the law, only justice, the socialists thereby assume that we reject fraternity, unity, organization, and association. The socialists brand us with the name individualist. But we assure the socialists that we repudiate only forced organization, not natural. We repudiate the forms of association that are forced upon us, not free association. We repudiate forced fraternity, not true fraternity. We repudiate the artificial unity that does nothing more than deprive persons of individual responsibility. We do not repudiate the natural unity of mankind under providence. And here I would like to pause for a moment and just say that if free people are a more moral people and are a more educated people, are a more giving people, they are in general a better people. Because things are not being organized for them. They must see to it that things are just, that people are taken care of, that people are educated. And in a Christian nation, which ours is, whether or not you're Christian or not, doesn't really matter. The important thing is that the rule of law is founded on Christian principles, religious principles. All right, we can just say religious principles. Whether or not you're religious, that's important because it benefits you also. But in a religious nation, as is ours, gosh, we have an obligation to our fellow man just because, you know, we were given to freely and freely we will give. And a good moral people will give to others and will take care of others. One of my friends who is leaning very much in the socialist direction and does not understand the law and does not understand the things that I'm talking about right now, once said to me, you know, well, people always say that if the government didn't do it, that people would do it and churches would do it, but they won't. And they don't. And you know, that's just not true. We are such a philanthropic nation. We take care of the rest of the world. We don't just take care of one another beyond taxes and give locally. We do give much locally, but we also give worldwide. Americans are very philanthropic, even though we've been burdened with a heavy tax and all these nonsense things. You know, we still are very giving, and I do not personally believe that there will be poor people in this country not taken care of. We have a deep and rich history of philanthropy, true philanthropy, not forced. All right, continuing on. Socialism, like the ancient ideas from which it springs, confuses the distinction between government and society. As a result of this, every time we object to a thing being done by government, the socialists conclude that we object to its being done at all, which is nonsense. We disapprove of state education. Then the socialists say that we are opposed to education. Nonsense. We object to a state religion. The socialists say that we want no religion at all. Nonsense. We object to a state enforced equality. Then they say that we are against equality, and so on and so on and so on. It is as if the socialists were to accuse us of not wanting persons to eat because we do not want the state to raise the grain. How did politicians ever come to believe this weird idea that the law could be made to produce what it does not contain? The wealth, science, and religion that, in a positive sense, constitute prosperity. Is it due to the influence of our modern writers on public affairs? Present-day writers, especially those of the socialist school of thought, base their various theories upon one common hypothesis. They divide mankind into two parts. People in general, with the exception of the writer himself, form the first group. The writer, all alone, forms the second and most important group. Surely this is the weirdest and most conceited notion that ever entered a human brain. In fact, these writers on public affairs begin by supposing that people have within themselves no means of discernment, no motivation to action. The writers assume that people are inert matter, passive particles, motionless atoms, at best a kind of vegetative indifferent to its own manner of existence. They assume that people are susceptible to being shaped. Now this is behaviorism, guys. Notice how this is starting to tie into education. People are susceptible to being shaped by the will and hand of another person into an infinite variety of forms, more or less symmetrical, artistic, and perfected. Moreover, not one of these writers on governmental affairs hesitates to imagine that he himself, under the title of organizer, discoverer, legislator, or founder, is this will in hand, this universal motivating force, this creative power whose sublime mission is to mold these scattered materials, persons, into a society. And listen, folks, society happens, okay? Civilization happens. It always has happened. It doesn't need this governing hand. These socialist writers look upon people in the same manner that the gardener views his trees. Just as the gardener capriciously shapes the trees into pyramids, parasols, cubes, vases, fans, and other forms, just so does the socialist writer whimsically shape human beings into groups, series, centers, subcenters, honeycombs, labor corps, which means workers, and that's being done in America, and other variations. And just as the gardener needs axes, pruning hooks, saws, and shears to shape his trees, just so does the socialist writer need the force that he can find, where? Only in the law, to shape human beings. For this purpose, he devises tariffs, tax laws, relief laws, and school laws. Do you see it now? Do you see why it's so important for socialists to be in government? Because they have to have force. Do you see force? Do you see that we force people to do things in this country? And then we wonder, why do we have such a violent country? Is it because we have guns? No, we have a government of force. We have a government with guns. We have a government with guns that says, you're going to pay up. You're going to pay for this girl over here to have an abortion. And you're going to pay for this guy over here to get money for crack or alcohol or whatever. You're going to do it. And if you don't do it, we're coming after you. And we will take your life, your liberty, and your property. And we wonder why we have violence in this country. Really? In my mind, it's not because of the guns that good people have. It's the guns that the government has. It's their might that makes them right. That's the problem. All right, continuing on. Socialists look upon people as raw material to be formed into social combinations. Remember, that's what the Skinnerians say. That's what the Wintians say. There's no individualism. It's just you're just this thing. We'll mold you into what we want you to be. This is so true that if by chance the socialists have any doubts about the success of these combinations, they will demand that a small portion of mankind be set aside to experiment upon. And folks, I don't know if you know it, but the Department of Energy radiated troops, foster children. They radiated tons of kids. I mean, there have been so many human experiments. The Nazis used American human experimentation during the Nuremberg trials. They pointed to our experimentation and said, well, you did it first. And it's true. We did. People are just animals. They're like rats, right? They're just to be experimented upon. The popular idea of trying all systems is well known, and one socialist leader has been known seriously to demand that the Constituent Assembly give him a small district with all its inhabitants to try his experiments on. And that's what's happening in education. Our kids are guinea pigs in schools. They're having little experiments run on them. Will this work? Will that work? It's disgusting. In the same manner, an inventor makes a model before he constructs the full-size machine. The chemist wastes some chemicals. The farmer wastes some seeds and land to try out an idea. But what a difference there is between the gardener and his trees, between the inventor and his machine, between the chemist and his elements, between the farmer and his seeds. And in all sincerity, the socialist thinks that there is the same difference between him and mankind. That is just a really powerful statement. And I have heard this said before, and this is just confirming what I've heard said, and I've begun to suspect that it was true, although honestly I did not believe it at first. These people, these social engineers, whether you're looking at, you know, bankers who set up the Federal Reserve, or philanthropists like Rockefeller who are, you know, do-gooders, or you know, socialists in government, they consider themselves to be like godlike, like the inventor, the farmer, and that everyone else are his material to work on. And because the material is not human and not individual, we are in effect, disposable, like we're replaceable. We are not. This is why we have abortion and all these other things. And this is why abortion, see, this is what I'm saying. This is why abortion and gay marriage are issues. It's an ideological problem, okay? If we don't fix this liberty issue, you're never going to see an end to those things. Because if there's no value to life, if there's no, hey, this person is an individual and they have rights and they have a right to life and a right to liberty and a right to property. And they are not here for me to control. Then see, a socialist system is very much about the elites, the leaders, controlling what everybody else does. And if you don't believe it, go to a socialist or a communist country and check it out for yourself. I had a prof one time in a Spanish class who was from Cuba. This is really funny. I don't know if I've told you this story. But you know, I was pregnant with my second child, just trying to finish up my degree. I had like, all I had left was Spanish credits, you know, so I had to finish those. And I'm sitting in this little junior college with, you know, the 18-year-olds or whatever. And he starts talking about, he left Cuba, you know, he escaped Cuba, escaped communism. And this one girl raises her hand and says, but isn't communism good because everybody has health care? And I adored this man's reaction. He wasn't harsh with her, but I think he was like stunned, you know, it was like, just what? And he wasn't mean to her or harsh to her, but he proceeded to set her straight on. And he was just telling her, you know, anecdotally, well, my brother had to go work in this factory and do this. He didn't want to do that, but it was decided for him. You see, he and his brother were not people. They were not individuals. They did not have liberty nor freedom. They were cogs in a machine, and somebody else would decide who they were and what they were going to be. We will never have liberty until we restore the personhood, the divinity, the rights of man. If you are a Christian who wants to get rid of abortion and get rid of gay marriage and get rid of immorality, I am here to tell you that the best way to do it is to restore the place of mankind through liberty. Please, for the love of heaven, stop voting Republican. Please just stop. If we would all just stop, something would change. All right. I digress. All right. It is no wonder that the writers of the 19th century look upon society as an artificial creation of the legislator's genius. That's why I call these people social engineers, by the way. This idea, the fruit of classical education, has taken possession of all the intellectuals and famous writers of our country. To these intellectuals and writers, the relationship between persons and the legislator appears to be the same as the relationship between the clay and the potter. All right, now, I'm not sure what he means that this is the fruit of classical education. And I would have to look more into what he meant by that. So I'm not even going to bother to speak on that, because I don't know what his basis for that is and what he means, and, you know, without defining his terms, what classical education means to him. But if I find out something about that, I definitely will talk to you about it. Suffice it to say, from my view, that the exact opposite of this is true in my view, that classical education teaches the divinity of man and the purpose of man and the rights of man. Moreover, even when they have consented to recognize a principle of action in the heart of man and a principle of discernment in man's intellect, they have considered these gifts from God to be fatal gifts. They have thought that persons under the impulse of these two gifts would fatally tend to ruin themselves. They assume that if the legislators left persons free to follow their own inclinations, they would arrive at atheism instead of religion, ignorance instead of knowledge, poverty instead of production and exchange. And you see here, what we were talking about is an inherent trust in mankind, that somehow there's divinity in mankind and that he's going to find his way. All right. According to these writers, it is indeed fortunate that heaven has bestowed upon certain men, governors and legislators, the exact opposite inclinations, not only for their own sake, but also for the sake of the rest of the world. While mankind tends toward evil, the legislators yearn for good. While mankind advances toward darkness, the legislators aspire for enlightenment. While mankind is drawn toward vice, the legislators are attracted toward virtue. Since they have decided that this is the true state of affairs, they then demand the use of force in order to substitute their own inclinations for those of the human race. Open at random any book on philosophy, politics, or history, and you will probably see how deeply rooted in our country is this idea. The child of classical studies, the mother of socialism. Interesting. That is really interesting. He says it again. I would love to talk to him and find out what he means by that. In all of them, you will probably find this idea that mankind is merely inert matter, receiving life, organization, morality, and prosperity from the power of the state. And even worse, oh, I see what he's saying. And even worse, it will be stated that mankind tends toward degeneration and is stopped from this downward course only by the mysterious hand of the legislator. Conventional classical thought everywhere says that behind passive society there is a concealed power called law or legislator, or called by some other terminology that designates some unnamed person or persons of undisputed influence and authority, which moves, controls, benefits, and improves mankind. All right, now this could be true from, I mean, I'm not sure, I haven't heard this or encountered this myself. This could be true classically, like Greek and Roman, the classical, the ancient classical education could have geared ideologically toward government being the saving hand. Now, I'm in a Christian classical environment, so we obviously view the guiding hand of humanity as Christ. But I see what he's saying now, and I don't agree with what he doesn't agree with. I mean, I do not agree that we should look to the law or the government as like the one who knows. Now, I have not personally encountered this in my studies of ancient writings, but I could, and if I do, I'll let you know. But suffice it to say that we can use the methodology and some of the ideology of classical education without turning it into this. I'm obviously very pro-liberty and pro-founding father. And most of the founding fathers, I believe, were educated in what I would consider a classical manner. But perhaps they had, maybe the theology of the Enlightenment was a little bit different. Perhaps. And so perhaps they got a little bit different theology. All right. Well, I'm at 30 minutes, so I'm going to wrap it up now. And next time we will continue on reading. And I have to tell you that it still does not look like I'm halfway through. Yeah, I think I am. And my throat is getting tired too, so I'm kind of happy to stop. All right, I will talk to you next time. Have a great one. Thanks.